Good evening, I'm Loreto Rojas. This time it's just myself. Carl Winslow couldn't be with us today. We have been celebrating Hispanic Heritage Month, learning about our country and neighboring countries in this program, talking about California. We have considered aspects of this heritage, both in an immediate sense, the crisis on the border, and in the background to this current crisis, immigration and the USA. Thus far, we have heard about DACA, about zero tolerance, about the children on the border, about Latino youth in the cities, immigrant workers, and more. All these programs can be found on the KZYX website. Look under Programs, then Public Affairs, and then Talking About California. This last program will take us a little further south to the heart of South America, Ecuador. This is where we find our guest of today, and her name is Diana Coriat. Professor Diana Coriat is a media educator and media activist who lives locally in Mendocino as well as in Ecuador. She is a professor of communication in Mendocino College and the University of the Americas in Quito, Ecuador. She is a practitioner and researcher in the area of community media and also focuses on how social movements use media and art to shift social imaginaries. She is the co-founder and former executive director of Global Action Project, a youth media organization based in New York City that for over 25 years has worked with young people most affected by injustice to build community power, cultural expression, and political change. She has worked with youth media collectives in Colombia, Croatia, Cuba, Ecuador, Guatemala, Northern Ireland, and Venezuela. She holds a master's and a PhD in communication from the University of Massachusetts Amherst and a Bachelor of Fine Arts from New York University. Good evening, Diana. How are you doing?
I am well. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you so much for speaking with us today. So we have been listening on the news about this national strike in Ecuador, and you are in Ecuador right now. Is that correct?
Yes, I am.
So could you tell us a little bit what it was about this national strike that just affected the nation of Ecuador in South America?
Sure. Well, it's been a very intense time. I'm going to talk about it at length because it's kind of complicated, but basically there has been 11 days of a national general strike across the country from October 3rd to the 13th. And basically I would characterize it as a popular uprising, but that was also complicated by intense of a lot of violence by followers of the former president. So let me unpack all of this. This started on October 3rd. The president of Ecuador, Lenin Moreno, gave a televised speech in which he described the austerity measures that the government was going to take in exchange for a loan from the International Monetary Fund, which I'll just keep calling the IMF. And that included a release in fuel subsidies. There have been fuel subsidies in this country for, 40 years or so. So the next day, the prices rose from anywhere from 25% to 123% in fuel, which actually means that complete increase in the cost of living right away, because with transportation costs of food and everything goes up, bus fare, et cetera. And this is what you would call a structural adjustment package. Ecuador was looking for a loan of over $4 billion from the IMF, and in exchange, they were to roll out this structural adjustment package. And it also included a curtailment of workers' rights. So for example, workers for the government that aren't salaried, but that were on contract, they were to be reduced across the board, their salaries by 20%. And we're talking about in an economy that's already been is in stagnation right now. People are already hurting. There's already been a large loss of jobs. So you can imagine how, the entire country took this. Now, the first thing that happened is the transportation workers, taxis and trucks, their union decided to go on strike. And that strike lasted for 2 days. But what began to happen, the indigenous people were organizing from across the country, because obviously this affects indigenous populations throughout the entire country. And they began a march on Quito and on other cities like Cuenca and Guayaquil. So it was a popular uprising throughout the entire country.
Yes, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but sure. I remember seeing in the news that actually the president had to flee the capital, that he went from Quito to Guayaquil, which is a town in the south, is the second most important city, as far as I know, in Ecuador. And the population, just people that was protesting against this, the measurements, economical measurements, they took the palace by assault and the Congress and everything was in disarray, right? It was a very powerful movement.
Well, like I said, it's very interesting. So yes, I mean, the thing that's really amazing is Lenin Moreno took off for Guayaquil when the indigenous folks were marching on Quito in the numbers of thousands. He says it was for the safety of his life, which, you know, could be true because, you know, let's just back up for a second. Ecuador is a country where in the late 90s to the early 2000s, three presidents were overthrown by popular protests, not by the military. Popular protests, people taking to the streets when they're angry about similar kinds of structural adjustments. So he felt that his life was at risk, and, you know, it could have been. So, but he went to Guayaquil, which is the second city. It has more of a population. It's not the government seat. It's more the business and commercial sector is concentrated in Guayaquil and the right wing, interestingly enough. Mm-hmm. So it was really interesting that he was away for most of the national strike. But one thing I wanted to double back on is that while he was looking for over $4 billion of loan, social organizations in this country had calculated that same amount of money had been given in tax exemptions to the large corporations. So banks alone in 2018, for example, had made over $550 million in profit. Also, because I want to get to like some of the roots of the anger, there's been widespread corruption from, you know, many governments, but the last government, President Correa, who, you know, is now out of the country, he's in Belgium, and by Moreno himself. So, for example, President Moreno receives two salaries. He receives one for being president, and he also has a lifelong salary for having been vice president. So, you know, people are just fed up. So it's like, the economic problems need to be solved, but hey, not on the backs of the working poor and rural families and the middle class. So, you know, we're looking at the wealthier really, you know, getting all these tax exemptions and privileges while the people that are mostly going to be affected are everybody else.
Right. And those are the ones that are affected directly by these economical decisions, because when the gas goes up, as you explained, then everything is more expensive. So the people took to the streets and the president had to flee the palace and the capital city. And then what happened?
Okay, so basically the country really went into paralysis. There were roadblocks everywhere, except for the indigenous and also peasant populations marching on Quito, Guayaquil, Cuenca, and other cities. There immediately, Moreno put into effect a state of emergency and a curfew. And that curfew, actually, a week later, it went from going 8 p.m. at night to 3 p.m. in the afternoon. So we calculated here in Quito, you know, I'm in Quito, so I'm going to speak mostly about Quito, but, keep in mind that these uprisings were going on across the entire country, actually in the Amazon as well. Three oil fields were shut down temporarily, three of the most important oil fields in Ecuador. So there were just estimations of up to 40,000 people in Quito, which included like more than 10,000 indigenous people. So it was a mix. There were peaceful marches, and they were accompanied also by riots and looting, which the indigenous people and all the people that were, all the social movements in alliance with this indigenous really distanced themselves from. So basically, I would say, you know, there's a criminal element always present, which takes advantage of any situation of chaos. That's one. And the other is that the government of Moreno, like I said, he was the vice president of Correa. So when Correa finished his term, they elected Moreno and Correa went to Belgium. And then there was a split in Alianza País, which is their political party. And they're actually enemies now. So Correa and his followers, he still has some followers in Ecuador, and also like the political elite of his followers, really used the moment to try to create even more chaos. So a lot was going on. So there was the rioting, the looting, and peaceful protest all at once. And there was one thing I really want to point out, is amazing acts of solidarity. So at least four universities, if not more, opened their doors to the indigenous folks who are marching in from all over to have a safe, hopefully safe place of refuge. Medical students came out one night. It was so bad because, and then there was also so much police violence against the population that really people hadn't seen, even in the dictatorships here. There was not this level of just, you know, where the indigenous people were housed in different universities and even hospitals. They were throwing, you know, tear gas on people in a maternity ward one night. So there was this unprecedented amount of police violence, but unprecedented amount, but also a tradition of this in Quito, of solidarity. So even, for example, people donating clothes, people cooking food in their houses, people coming out to the universities to cook, people bringing medicine, even the sheet metal workers were making shields for people. So we have, you know, the military armed, the police with tear gas and bullets, and then we have the indigenous folks with their traditional indigenous guards. What do they have? They have spears, which are mostly symbolic. They have spears, and then they had these, you know, shields, and people were making shields out of recycled plastic and things like that. So that was going on. So it was very hard to stay in touch with what was going on at any moment, because things were happening so quickly and different kinds of protests were happening throughout the city. So there was a lot of fear
among the population. Sorry to interrupt you again, but I read in the news that at least seven people died or were killed during these demonstrations. Thousands were arrested.
Now, I believe it's a dozen or more.
So the number is growing now.
Well, the official account came out yesterday saying that there were eight deaths, but other is a dozen or more. And just to give you a full scale before we get into the details, over 1,192 people were detained during these 11 days. Now, 76% of them were released without charges because they were actually arbitrary and illegal arrests. The defense of the Defensoría del Pueblo said that. And a quarter of the people that were arrested were between the ages of 15 and 24 years old. So there were also up maybe 1,500 people that were injured. And that's an official count, 1,340. And that does not include the people that were attended to in the universities. So it's actually much higher. And like I said, probably at least a dozen. I was with somebody yesterday who was attending to the sick, and two young people died yesterday morning. And on top of that, many, many human rights violations that have not been accounted for yet.
Yeah, very dear situation happening in Ecuador. So yesterday when you and I were talking about this interview, you remind me of a fact that I thought is quite relevant for our program. And I mean, in general, the symbolism that this demonstrations and this national strike actually finished the day after October 12th, which is considered, you know, the day when Christopher Columbus so-called discovered America. So I wanted you to talk a little bit about the symbolism also as well.
Well, it's symbolic and it's real. Indigenous power. So, you know, like I said, the strike started with transportation workers, but really the people who were movers and shakers and historically have been in Ecuador were indigenous. And the level of organization is really unparalleled. Now, the indigenous movement here had been weakened during the times of Correa and before that. But what really came out in this march, what was really noticeable, I mean, it had been noticeable to people who are following social movements all along, like myself and many other people, but for the population, what emerged now, which is relatively new, was really the protagonism of Indigenous women. And they were at the forefront of the march. And this we've been seeing, the Amazonian women here had marched on Quito several times before this to really put out their voices against the oil drilling that continues to happen in the Amazon. But yeah, I mean, I just think it's so interesting because I feel like there's this growing global consciousness that, you know, I mean, in the U.S., how many cities now, including Mendocino, have gotten rid of Columbus Day and are, you know, replacing it with Indigenous Day? It's called different things. You know, the day is called something different in different places. But, you know, I think this is happening all over the world. It's also happening in Canada. So, I mean, Indigenous folks, they know that they're powerful. They know who they are historically. But really to get the rest of the population to recognize the real long-term resistance of Indigenous people against all forms of colonization up to the present time is really interesting. So the march ended on October, you know, the national strike and the violence ended on Sunday night, October 13th. And I think it's the very next day, it's usually October 12th, but I think being a Monday, it was Columbus Day. It was also, you know, Indigenous Day in the U.S. And a lot of people in Ecuador, I noticed on in social media and Facebook and Twitter, were talking about that as well. So there is this exchange going on. And at the same time, people in the United States, I mean, Democracy Now! And other groups were televising what was going on in Ecuador. So there's this exchange of looking at this Indigenous leadership.
Right. And another thing that caught my attention while I was following what was happening in Ecuador was the way the media and the press were covering this. You know, at the beginning, I found out about this national strike and the demonstrations in the streets and all the dramatic images that were available through actually social media platforms. And people were just replicating or tweeting about what was happening. And I read there, and you also mentioned it to me, that the local media, you know, the television channels and the most visible media, they were actually not reporting about what was happening inside of the country. And this is also something that created quite a response from the people saying, I mean, what's going on? We are having a big political, economical issue and a wide demonstration of popular demands of changes, and the actual media is showing cartoons in the television. So could you talk a little bit about this? Because I think this is not anything new, but at the same time, with the power of the media, you know, one would think that it shouldn't be the case, that actually there will be reports about this, such an important situation.
Yeah, I mean, it was really interesting. I mean, I'm a communication scholar and also a media activist. And so these are things that I follow really closely. And like you said, it does have historical precedence. And it always depends on the relationship of the government with the media, right? So let's go back to the popular overthrows of the 1990s in Ecuador. The media was not reporting anything. Now, at that point, let's say in the late 1990s and the early 2000s, you know, the internet was up and running. There was much less access in Ecuador. It wasn't something that people relied on. So at one point, when there was a lot of popular protests, the media, the mainstream media that were in alliance with the government weren't reporting anything, except there was one radio station that was telling people what was going on, and that was called Radio La Luna. And people would come out, and if people listened to Radio La Luna, that was like kind of the only source of information that people had about what was actually happening on the streets. So now let's fast forward to this national strike. The mainstream media is very much aligned with the government right now, which was not true under Correa. So under Correa, they covered the social movements, not because they were pro-social movement, but because they were anti-Correa. And right now, the mainstream media was very much aligned with the government. And it wasn't as much they were not covering what was going on, but they were also the way they framed it. So, for example, they framed the protesters as violent instead of the police and the military. So they highlighted, you know, kind of all the protesters are violent. So they were kind of creating fear in the rest of the population. and also coming to kind of, you know, really not highlighting what the police were doing. So, but, you know, then there were all these alternative media that have sprung up in the last few years. And we can also talk, you know, now or a little later about this whole social movement of communication rights right now. But there are so many groups right now, mostly young people.
Yes, that please tell us about. This is very interesting to hear.
Uh-huh. Well, there's so many young people right now that have, you know, media tools, right? I mean, obviously, if you have a smartphone, you can record what's going on right there. But there's that level of, like, people on the street recording. But there are also a lot of small media collectives. They're collectives. They really don't make any money. They're nonprofit. And they were out there really recording and reporting on what was going on. So while there's all this chaos in the street and the television is playing cartoons or just, you know, saying a few generalities and people are stuck in their homes, locked in their homes, afraid of criminal elements coming to break into their house, and they're trying to find out what's going on, people would go on to Facebook. Facebook is very popular. And they would go to these radio stations, you know, the online radio, and also and they were transmitting, they were young people on the streets reporting with video, live video, showing what was going on and speaking. And then, you know, there's a group called Wambra Radio, who's excellent. I know them personally. I work with them, full disclosure, you know, as a volunteer here and there. But they were having in-depth interviews with indigenous leaders, with feminists, with other social movements to talk about what was going on. So they were doing firsthand reporting, but also really sophisticated analysis. And just to back up, Wambra Radio, they were actually about 18, 19 years old, and they were in Radio La Luna back in 2005, 2006, when that radio station was calling people onto the streets. So it's interesting that, you know, many years later, they were now leading these efforts. But there was also just regular citizens going out into their neighborhoods and recording and saying, this is what's happening. Look at these military trucks on the highway. Look at what's happening. Look what's going on. Look, you know, and so people were recording. So, you know, for myself, the mainstream media, I could not rely on them. I mean, I'd rather see, you know, the dad on the street who's put on his cell phone. It seemed more real to actually see a little piece of what was going on in a certain neighborhood that I didn't have access to. So people, regular folks, and also these communication collectives were recording videos. There were photo essays. There were drones. There's a lot of people that have small drones right now. And these videos are still being compiled. A great amount of photojournalism. Right now in Ecuador, there are many film schools and a lot of indigenous media too. So there's a lot of young indigenous people that have media. So they were also transmitting from different parts of the country. So the scenario in terms of what you could choose to look at was very interesting. There was also a lot, and still continues to today, a lot of criminalization of these alternative media groups that were talking about what was going on. So there was a lot of fear of search and seizure. There was a search and seizure of Radio Pichincha. That's not an alternative media. It's a mainstream private radio that's actually pro-Correa, and they were kind of inciting the pro-Correa elements in the country. So the government went in very quickly and did search and seizure on them. But I know alternative media across the country were very afraid of that. And they're still to this day, something came out in one of the newspapers that's aligned with the government that's talking about that these young people in alternative media are not alternative media, that they're actually putting out propaganda, and they're really continuing to criminalize them. So these are media groups that are still very much under the, you know, eye of the government right now, and they feel incredibly threatened by them. There was actually a pronouncement that came out, I think, yesterday by independent, alternative, popular, indigenous community, and digital media groups of Ecuador. That pronouncement, they're saying, number one, that the government sought to systematically delegitimize their reporting, which they're continuing to do, but that their efforts on the street actually helped to break the silence of conventional media. Because one thing that happened, one of the days there was a popular assembly of the people, And Wambra Radio was covering it. And it was extraordinary because while the mainstream media was saying, we have 8 journalists being held hostage in this assembly, those journalists were getting up in the assembly saying, I am not being held hostage. I am here because I want to cover what's happening. And so, you know how, like when you watch a watch party or you see something online, you have a whole chat going on the side. So I was watching the chats, and the chats were saying, why isn't mainstream media covering this? And call Tele Amazonas, call El Comercio. They need to cover this. So they actually kind of forced the media into more coverage. But at the same time, this pronouncement also talks about that they were censored, they were shut down, their digital communication was intervened, there was a lot of intimidation. And so there was basically a wide-scale aggression against freedom of expression and communication rights, which are in the constitution of this country.
We must pause here for a moment. My name is Loreto Rojas, your host today. This is KZYX, Mendocino County, listener-supported radio. And our guest this evening is Diana Coriat. She's a practitioner and researcher in the area of community media. And currently she's in Ecuador and telling us about the situation in this country. Yes, it's going back to the topic about the media and mainstream media and the alternative media. I was not surprised, sadly, that there were many journalists that were hurt during these protests and demonstrations. Mm-hmm. 115, I read, and also 6 other radio stations or, you know, groups of journalists were actually raided and stopped their broadcasting. So this is nothing really new, unfortunately, as I was saying, because we also see that in many other countries, perhaps including our own country here in the United States, the media belongs to a very powerful groups, and they decide what can be shared or broadcast, and they decide what topics should be silenced. So This is what we saw in Ecuador, right?
Absolutely. And like you said, it's nothing new. And it just, you know, shifts according to who is in power. So, for example, when President Correa was in power, there was a large scale criminalization of the media. And the only, I have to say, at the time, you know, I came here in 2012 to study this really new revolutionary communication law that was going to be put into effect. And it was in the constitution here. So let's talk about rights, okay? Ecuador in 2008 came out with a really progressive constitution, okay? And it included something that was unprecedented in the world, although there were different efforts going on in South America, like in Argentina, to do this, which was the division of the broadcast spectrum. So what would that mean? They were saying that they were going to give, you know, 33% of the spectrum would be for private media, which right now has probably like 99%, right? 98, if not more. 33% for, you know, different nonprofit media. For government media. And then 34% for community media, which honestly, they included religion in that too, which that brings it down for community media. But anyway, imagine like what our media would look like if a third of it was run by community media. Okay, so I came here to study that. Now, that did not happen. What happened
was... So, excuse me, I'm going to interrupt you, but what you're saying is that all the time where information was aired needed to be shared by these 3 different groups?
Or... Well, what if it was put in the Constitution that they were going to divide the broadcast spectrum equally among private, public, which was government, basically, and community media. That never happened. Right now in Ecuador, as in most of the world, you know, corporate media still controls over 90% of the media, right? Although state media is more in different places.
Right. This is what really is being broadcast. It's mostly actually the mainstream media, even when the constitutions...
My point, though, is during Korea, it was very similar to what we're experiencing in the U.S. right now. If you want to talk about kind of tendencies where we have like a president in this country that demonizes media. He calls most media, especially media that's critical of him, fake news, right?
Oh,
And only the
that rings a
media
bell.
that agrees with him is legitimate and real, and only really his Twitter is real and everything else is fake. So President Correa had the same kind of campaign against any critical media, whether they were private, alternative community. Anyone who criticized him and his government was subject to harassment, jailing, fines, being shut down. Now, in our country, there's enough institutionality that Trump, although I'm sure he would love to do it, you know, would love to shut down the media. But here in Ecuador, it actually happened. They, you know, would give them so many fines that they would go bankrupt. And he did so many things to intimidate, harass, jail journalists and the media outlets themselves. So the media at that point, the mainstream media was really, you know, at war with Correa. But that's changed since Lenin Moreno has come in. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, no, it does. And I know this is a very specific issue. And for if you are just joining us, listeners, we are talking with Diana Coriat about the situation in Ecuador and trying to understand more how this actually permeates many other countries, including perhaps our own country. And of course, when we see that the media changes sides depending who is in charge of the government, is of course it's not unusual, unfortunately. But I wanted to go back to these social movements, because one of the images I saw was of an indigenous woman, and they dressed very traditionally with these small black hats and the skirts that are very, how do you say, really big. Which is very distinctive of the Andes region. You know, I come from Chile, so I in the north of the country, I see many people dressed in the traditional way. So, Diana, one of the images I saw, it was of this indigenous woman in the middle in a street in Quito, and she's wearing the traditional outfit, you know, and a big amp skirt and a very simple shoes. And then the small black hat, and she was wearing a mask because you could see that she was in between all the smoke of the tear gas that it was used to repress people. And this is the image of an indigenous woman that this can be found in other countries of the region. You know, Ecuador belongs to the same chain of mountains, the Andes, and the indigenous people are easily identified by their clothing and features. So you see people dressed like this in Bolivia, Chile, of course in Peru and Ecuador. So could you tell us
Bolivia.
A little bit? Yeah. So could you tell us a little bit more about these people, if they, what's the name they used to call themselves and how they are organized? And
yeah, well, you know, that's a very big question. So let me break it down in a few different ways. So the social movement here, which is a historic social movement, is called La Conai. Okay, so if you see Conaie, La Conai is the social movement. Now, the indigenous population of Ecuador, there are different kind of statistics that go between, I think, like 6 and 8% of the country. But, you know, historically, they've been very well organized. And so that was the main social movement that was leading the struggle. Now, what's interesting, just let me back up about social movements in Ecuador. Social movements in Ecuador are really at a really interesting place right now. Now, during Correa, there was this, they've always, you know, really since I'd say the indigenous movement really began to organize in the 60s, 70s, there were major indigenous uprising in the 90s. Feminist movements and ecologist movements, which are also very important, started more in the 80s. And then there's also student movements and many different kinds of unions. So Ecuador has always been a place where there's been a lot of social movements and a lot of activity and a lot of dynamic activity and organization by social movements. And there, it really, you know, during Correa, because he was originally with the social movements and then he just turned on them and began to criminalize them, there was really, it was a time where there was less social movement activity in the country. But now they have regrouped and also reorganized, and there's new generations in. So that right now, I'd say since 2013 or so, Correa was still in power, there's this like flourishing of social movements. So let me give you an example. So the indigenous social movement historically has been strong, but right now women are the protagonists. So I had mentioned before, Amazonian women marching on Quito several times to express their dissent from the extraction that's going on in the area. Feminist movements are very strong right now. Young feminists are coming out against the abortion laws, which you cannot get an abortion in Ecuador or in most of Latin America, increasingly in the U.S., unless the woman is considered, mentally retarded is the only way, not even by rape. So there's moves to at least get the abortion laws to include rape. Then the ecological movements are very strong right now as well. And there's something interesting going on in Ecuador and also all over South America. And there's a wonderful theorist, if anybody here really likes to read about this stuff, because she writes in English as well, is Maristela Svampa, which is S-V-A-M-P-A. And she's from Argentina. And she talks about this eco-territorial turn in social movements. And, you know, one way that I interpret that is that movements, including the feminist movement, are looking at territories. And they're looking at the kind of connection between bodies and territories. So feminists, ecologists, and indigenous movements are, you know, with all the tensions that any movements have among each other and inside each other, they're more aligned. So that's what's going on right now. And what came out really strongly in this march was this new generation of indigenous leaders that are young. So it's the traditional folks are still there. It's not that they've left. Some have left, obviously. But there's these new young people, and they're not just coming from what they call, as you know, in Latin America, orgánica. So they're not just desde las bases. They're not only from traditional agricultural territorial bases, that organic social movement leaders, but there are now a whole generation of young indigenous people that have been educated in universities in Ecuador and from all over the world. And they're also part of the movement, and they came out really strongly, and the media makers. So that's going on. And there was, you know, again, getting back to March, a lot of solidarity among and alliance, you know, allies among the different social movements. So, but you know, getting back to who are the indigenous people in Ecuador, they're called pueblos y nacionalidades, and there are many. There are different groups. One of the dominant groups is Quechua, and the Quechua are in the Amazon and also in the highlands. And so the outfit that you're talking about is very typical of highland indigenous people.
Right.
And the Amazonians have a different, obviously they're not going to dress in clothes that will be that hot in the Amazon, but they have different ways. When you see Amazonian indigenous people, like if you're looking over in social media and you're looking at the different photos and you see people that have painted faces, often that those people are coming from the Amazon, not only, but mostly from the Amazon. And there, you know, the Quechua is spoken by both. And there are many other groups. There's, you know, the Shuar are very strong. They were here as well. There's also the Wauroni. They were the last contacted. They've only been in contact for about, you know, 50 years. So there's many different indigenous groups. So I don't want to generalize. And there are many different indigenous movements. And they're not all part of the CONAI, but many of them are. But they're fighting, you know, them as well as feminists now and ecologists are fighting against, you know, the colonization of our bodies and of our territories. And that's how people are looking at the movements.
Yes, this is very interesting. We just interviewed in this program, which, by the way, is called Talking About California. Last week, we interviewed Rachel de la Cruz, and she was talking about Salvadorian people and how actually they have to, the indigenous people of Salvador have to abandoned their traditional clothing and distanced themselves from the indigenous population because of the way that the governments treated this population. So it's uplifting to hear that actually in Ecuador, people continue to keep their ways and demand this territory and demanding changes in the way that they are treated by the not only the media, but of course their own government.
Yeah, the dress varies. I mean, that those are processes that happen all over Latin America. So, for example, the university that I work in, which is a private university, I've talked to indigenous students, and they feel like they're going to be discriminated against if they wear their indigenous clothing. So very few do. So you know, if you come to the city, you'll see people in indigenous kind of clothing, but you'll also see a lot of people just regularly in jeans and t-shirts. And that holds true in the Amazon. And so it's varied, you know, and a lot of people will come out, like, so for example, for marches or for ceremonial occasions, people will all come out dressed in the finest indigenous clothing, but for day to day, maybe not. It's almost like, I don't want to say individual choice because they're very collective communities. And, you know, I do want to speak about one other thing, Loretta, that I think is so important. So one thing that came out in the march was still the continued racism and classism against indigenous people. So, you know, there's a lot of cultural disconnects. So I want to give you one anecdote. So in the social media, that, you know, there was a lot of people were denouncing the fact that the police were throwing tear gas into the places where there were women and children. And so people, mestizos from the middle class and upper middle class from the city, were saying, well, why did these people bring their children into harm's way? And so number one, people said, well, is that the right question to be asking? You're asking why women and children are there, why women brought their children, but you're not asking why the police are throwing tear gas into these sites. And then another, you know, theme that came out very strongly, a lot of indigenous women answered in social media, and they said, this is what community is to indigenous people. Community is when one person gets up to march, everyone gets up to march, everyone leaves. That means the old people, the young people, the women, the babies, everyone is there. So, you know, you come up with this really, this image of like, what does it mean to be in community? And what does it mean to be in resistance? And how has this resistance actually been able to continue because of these, you know, Andean and indigenous kind of cosmovisions and philosophies about how you have to live your life?
Right. So for any popular movement, this is very important. You need the populace, the people. And of course, many times the emphasis is put in a very strange place, as you were just describing. So I wanted to go back to this idea that you were telling us about the eco-territorial movement or the feminine territory and related to environmental movements. Because when I was reading about your work, I ran into this word that I'm not so familiar. It's called extractivism. Could you explain a little bit about this term and what it means in that region and I imagine many other places in the world? Because our problem with the ecosystem and the change on the climate, it's affecting all of us.
Yeah, exactly. So basically, let's start from the fact that Latin America is very rich in what are called natural resources. So that means in oil, in all kinds of minerals, in water, in energy, in agriculture. And so extractivism, you know, many people define it in many different ways, but basically these days, and people talk about extractivism and neo-extractivism or new kinds of new modalities in extractivism. So basically what they're talking about are these large scale and high intensity exploitation of different, of nature. I'll just say of nature, of the oil in the ground, of the minerals in the ground. And they're basically, you know, these are all primary export kind of countries. So they're exporting all of these resources, all of these minerals, et cetera, without, they're just unprocessed and they're just being exported. And so one thing to call to mind is that this modality of accumulation, a capital accumulation basically, began, you know, with colonization over 500 years ago, right? So when the Spanish came over, going back to Columbus Day, right? Mm-hmm. Getting away with Columbus Day. You know, what did the Spanish do? They took out the gold. So you go and you
silver
see churches
in Peru.
So this is not new. It just takes on different forms. So it's a structural feature of capitalism, which many theorists say capitalism began with colonization. So it's the appropriation of nature, and with it comes the eviction of people from their territories, lots of violence, increased inequalities, and oftentimes it's like the capital is extracting wealth from the periphery, right? They're extracting wealth from, in this case, let's say the Amazon. And there's always this promise, you know, when they began to do large-scale oil extraction in the 70s in Ecuador, although it started in the 30s and 40s, when they started to really, you know, drill for oil on a larger scale. I said, the Amazon is going to be rich. Ecuador is going to be rich. But that never happened. You know, the profits go right to the corporations. And in neo-extractivism, when like the so-called left-wing government said, well, we're going to put the profits back into the country. We're not going to let them drain out to the corporations. That happened to some extent. But really, you know, the Amazon region is still the poorest region of Ecuador. And it's not only in the Amazon. They are in the páramos, which are the páramo are the kind of above the tree line, very high up in the Andes, these beautiful sites where they're like the source of water, water and life. As people say, water and life are the same thing. There's so many fights right now against the extraction of water. And so this impacts indigenous people primarily, but not only. And it, you know, impacts everybody's health. And so ecologists began their fight in the 80s. You know, there have been many, many, many struggles. But the recent one that I'd love to tell you super briefly about was in the Amazon about the Yasuni. So, you know, talking about Ecuador's, again, very progressive constitution, it was the first constitution in the world that have the rights of nature. So what does that mean? So many constitutions say that people have the right to a clean environment. But this says that nature is a subject of rights. Nature itself has rights. La Pachamama, as it's called in Andean culture. And so
Mother Earth, by the way, you know, Pachamama, it's Mother Earth.
Mother Nature.
Mother mm-hmm. Nature, and is worshipped widely in South America. This is the way, you know, I grew up in Chile, and we honor Pachamama. It's very important for us culturally and I mean, in many levels, of course, because it provides us with everything. So sorry to interrupt you.
No, it's absolutely true. And it's, I don't know if worship, but also just respected. And so another really important concept here. So along with the rights of nature, there's a concept called buen vivir, or good living. And it's not like the capitalist good living, like, yeah, I want a car and a house and a good job. You know, it's really buen vivir talks about people and nature living in harmony. So these are, you know, really indigenous wisdom, you know, millenary indigenous wisdom that really are back in the public light because it's in the Constitution. It also means we can fight for it. So Correa, he had this, he had taken from the social movements, you know, borrowed from them, but in a great way. He said that the Yasuni, which is the most biodiverse place on the planet, which is in the Ecuadorian Amazon, we were going to leave the oil in the soil. And that meant that we were going to ask Germany and other countries in Europe to help pay Ecuador the money that they were going to lose from not, you know, taking out the oil. And so for people that live in the Amazon, the oil is the blood. It's the blood of the earth. Okay, so taking it out, it's like sucking the blood out of your body, okay? And so there's this beautiful initiative called Yasuni ITT, Leave the Oil in the Soil. And in that 2013, he said, we can't do it anymore. We don't have enough support from the European and the West and the global North, and we're abandoning it. We're going to exploit oil in the Amazon, you know, I mean, in this part of the Amazon, because the Amazon is already very heavily intervened. And young people in the cities rose up. I mean, in addition to indigenous people who are always rising up against this, right? And so they were called, and they are called, they're still around, called the Yasunidos, Yas Unidos, like we're united for the Yasuni. And these young ecologists, you know, in their 20s mostly, but not only, grew up with the idea of the rights of nature. So these are imaginaries that are shifting, you know, so it's like they're ancient knowledges about how human beings should interact with nature, not just as exploiters of, but as caretakers of, and as really ensuring the balance. So these are things that were, and I notice more and more in the United States, we talk about this a lot now in the United States. It's part of the discourse all over the world, but people recognize Ecuador as one of the first places where this was happening. And so during the strike, getting back to that, it was a big question. It's like, well, they're doing away with fuel subsidies, and oh, you ecologists, you know, you're such hypocrites, because shouldn't that make Ecuador a greener place? If you do away with fuel subsidies, then people will consume less oil, et cetera, et cetera. But the answer to that is no, because the government has not been investing in green economy. So there's also this, the strike behind, you know, the decreto, the decree that Lenin Moreno wanted to put out, which included all these austerity measures. People are saying, no, that's just on the backs of poor people again. But where are the investments? Why are you still, you know, why are we not looking towards the future when we shouldn't be investing just in oil and mining? And, you know, how do we caretake what we have here? And so these are really, again, very, very important movements that are working daily to, you know, across the country, trying to stop mining, trying to stop palm oil, you know, mono agriculture. So there's so much going on in that way. You know, Loreto, I realize I didn't talk to you about the end of what actually happened with the paro, and I'd like to just
Getting ready to tell you that this is so very interesting, because, and this is why I wanted to finish our Hispanic Heritage series talking with you about Ecuador, because I think we can see in one country all the conflicts that are faced by many other countries in a perhaps a smaller scale, because Ecuador is not as big as Brazil or the United States for that matter, and people could actually move from the periphery and from these regions that are very biodiverse and different in climate and geography. I mean, Ecuador is a jewel in South America. So in a small scale, we can see conflicts and problems that are faced by many other nations. So I really want to hear what happened at the end. Although it feels that this type of social movements, there is never an end of them.
There's no end.
Right. So you reach some kind of an agreement, which I know this diverse group of organizations that fought so bravely against the government and the police brutality. And eventually I know the army went to kind of say, well, okay, we need to stop all this violence because we're just having a fight among ourselves. So tell us what happened with the end of the conflict, or at least the national strike. It happened recently, just last Sunday. So when this program will be aired, it will be just a week away from the end of the conflict. So tell us what was the agreement between the social movements and the government?
Okay, so you're so right to say it's not the end. I just call it like un respiro. It's like a breather. but basically, the levels of violence against people, the complete national strike and paralyzation of the country, it could not keep going on. It was getting more and more exasperated every day. So even though each side, let's say the two sides, they're different sides, obviously, but the government and the indigenous leaders that were, you know, really leading this whole national strike had a dialogue, and they had their terms seemed very different. I honestly didn't think anything was going to come of it myself, but basically, I just want to say the night before on Saturday night, October 12th, there was a cacerolazo, which is basically very historic in Latin America, but people, well, like when there is a curfew, they can't go out, but the way they show their support of the indigenous marchers and of, you know, what they were proposing, everybody takes their pots and pans and bangs them either inside their house or outside their house. So all over the country, people were sending in videos on social media of everyone banging pots and pans. So you could just hear the clamor and hear all the support. So the next day, there was a televised dialogue. The indigenous people said they did not want this to be a backroom dialogue where people could later say, oh, what do they really talk about? So there was a televised dialogue that had Lenin Moreno, the president of the country, and some other folks around him, with three indigenous leaders, including one woman who's the president of Sarayaku community, the Sarayaku people, who are Quechua of the Amazon, very strong group, and two indigenous male leaders around the table. And basically, the indigenous leaders really forced the government to withdraw this Decree 883, it was called, which was basically what the IMF wanted the government to do, to enact these austerity measures. So basically, they said, no, we're not going to amend it. You need to revoke it. It needs to be revoked. Decree 883, done. And so that happened. The government agreed to it on television.
And this was the decree that was raising the prices of gas.
The very next day was out of effect. Everything was suspended. Everything was canceled. So basically what they're doing, that doesn't mean it's the end of the story. So what was agreed upon, there's going to be setting up a commission that includes the indigenous people and other social movement leaders to renegotiate what kind of measures are going to be taken to, you know, help the Ecuadorian economy. Another thing that's in the Ecuadorian constitution is that this is an intercultural and plurinational nation, meaning you have to take all the members into account. And so the challenge is still to build a nation that really truly is intercultural and plurinational. And, you know, I also want to tell you a little bit about the proposals. And there are many proposals. I'm just going to go over some super quickly.
Well, I'm so sorry to tell you that actually we don't have more time to talk about those proposals. But I look forward to talk to you again about Ecuador and how things are permeating over there. But I wanted to say thank you so much for being with us this evening. This is being very informative. And I know many of our listeners would like to learn more about what's happening in Ecuador now that you have given us such an insider's point of view and explaining so many topics that are hard to understand when this news comes for so briefly time into our...
Thank you. But there's so much to unpack. I hope I just made it understandable to most people that are not like deep in this. You're right. It's a microcosm of what's happening all over the world. So if you can understand Ecuador, you're going to have insight into what's happening globally.
Thank you so much, Diana. And thank you so much to all of our listeners. This was talking about California, and we hope we'll be back in the future with another series about what's happening in our nation and elsewhere. Good night.